Welcome to the Unstoppable Recording Machine Podcast, brought to you by Hairball Audio. For nearly a decade, Hairball Audio has been helping musicians and recording studios improve their recordings by offering high-quality outboard recording equipment in do-it-yourself kit form. Check out the full line of compressors, mic preamplifiers, and do-it-yourself parts at hairballaudio.com. Hairball Audio. Do it yourself without compromise. This episode of the podcast is also brought to you by Shure Legendary Microphones, cutting-edge wireless systems, premium earphones and headphones. Shure, the most trusted audio brand worldwide. For more information, go to Shure.com. And now your host, A.L. Levy.
Welcome to the URM podcast. I am A.L. Levy. And I just want to tell you that this show is brought to you by URM Academy, the world's best education for rock and metal producers. Every month on Nail the Mix, we bring you one of the world's best producers to mix a song from scratch from artists like Lamb of God, Meshuga, Periphery, A Day to Remember, Bring Me the Horizon, Opeth, many, many more. And we give you the raw multi-tracks so you can mix along. You'll also get access to MixLab, our collection of bite-sized mixing tutorials, and Portfolio Builder, which are pro-quality multi-tracks that are cleared for use in your portfolio. You can find out more at nailthemix.com.
Welcome to the URM podcast. I'm A.L. Levy, and I am getting ready to go to NAMM. You're going to hear this a while after NAMM, but just know that I'm about to go there, and I hope I see quite a few of you there. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be our first time having a booth, and what can I say? Stoked about it. This is also a good podcast episode. My guest today is Nick Rad, and he's a mix engineer and producer from the Chicago area, and he's worked with bands like Stone Sour, Skillet, artists like Hilary Duff, The Color Morale, and many, many more. But what's especially interesting about this episode and why I want you to check it out is because I think it's relevant for those of you who are looking to make this your career. It's relevant because it shows just what's possible without having some smash hit. So without further ado, I give you Nick Rad, and enjoy. All right, so Nick Rad, welcome to the URM podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I just want to jump right into it because I have a lot of questions. You work with all different types of artists, and quite a few of them are at pretty high levels, but worlds apart in terms of genre. And so I'm curious about this. You know, when you look at artists like Hilary Duff versus Stone Sour versus Skillet, or The Color Morale, or anybody else you've worked with that's achieved a lot, is there anything in common that you find between all those acts, regardless of if they're heavy as fuck or some pop singer?
Man, that's a good question. I don't even know if I have a good answer of how all that came to be, except for, that's kind of a long story, but me going back to the beginning of how I started doing production work and how I started doing, coming from being in bands till I was 25, 26, and then at 26 to starting to get into production full on. I mean, the one thing that I could take away, what I wanted to do when I started doing production, was making just things be polished. And I think that was just my taste of how I hear music, because I like things to be, you know, perfect, kind of pop, and that's my taste. So I think going into my rock background, I wanted to start making records with rock and make it to be just polished, going through and taking the time to edit the drums, guitars, you know, make sure vocals are tuned. And so I think my work along the years kind of just gradually went into this pop, more of this pop era, sense here. And I started getting some work from Ledger and the Hilary Duff, Rachel Platten, that kind of stuff, where people were, I just kind of got good at making vocalists especially sound really good in the post side of things. So that just kind of went into different realms of how I got all these different kinds of genres under my belt, which is, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I enjoy it all. I enjoy going from the rock into the Hilary Duff and into, you know, whatever, because it's just a, it's a nice, like, change for me, I feel.
Well, it's interesting because I think that sometimes it actually can be a bad thing, but there's a few people, outliers, and I would consider you one of them, but there are a few outliers among producers that are doing well who can jump around genres. Typically, I find that someone experiences some success in a genre, and that becomes their calling card or their pigeonhole. You know, it's a blessing and a curse, and it's tough for them to move out of it, especially in metal. It's that way.
Sure.
Where once you've done like a few big metal records, all the metal bands start coming to you, and it's like, well, do I want to switch gears and turn that faucet off because they're just going to go to the next guy, or do I want to keep this train rolling? And it's actually a very serious question because, you know, if you divert your attention, the train could stop rolling. They could just go on to the next guy. So I think it's a very serious question that someone has to ask themselves. But, you know, I don't think that that many, and I consider producers artists, I don't think that that many artists are great at lots of different things. I think they typically find their voice. And sometimes, though, their voice is compatible with multiple styles, but it usually isn't, in my opinion. So it's kind of an outlier thing.
Sure, sure. And I think, too, for me, I didn't really have a big record in my career that kind of like took me onto one path. And that's probably why I got into all these different kinds of genres, because I was just kind of like the guy that just kind of did work, and it was just word of mouth and kind of that, you know, that grew. So
first of all, I just want to key in on something you said earlier. It sounds to me like like you said, the common bond is the polish. So that's what you're bringing to everything you do. And so that's where it sounds to me like that's where the compatibility lies, is in the perfection that you'll bring to each project. But I also think that most producers don't have like some huge record. Like, we hear about the ones with a huge record because it's a huge record. But I think that, you know, they're the statistical minority. I think most producers that are employed, doing well, supporting themselves and living like a respectable life, didn't have some smash hit. Like, they did a bunch of good work for a long time, word of mouth spread, and, you know, they built a career.
That's pretty much exactly where I live, right? What you just said. Yeah.
Well, I mean, sure, but you have worked with some pretty large artists. So there's some people who sustain that off of local markets only. But I guess my point just being, though, that I think it's a myth that you need to have some huge smash hit to your name in order to make this whole production thing work.
I would totally agree. Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this out since 2006 is when I went full time with doing production. Actually, 2008 is more of a full time thing for me. But coming from bands that I've been in and producers that we've worked with, one comes to mind: Jason Livermore and Bill Stevenson from the Blasting Room in Fort Collins, Colorado. We made two records with those guys, and just learning from those guys and their work ethic, that pretty much changed my life and in how I do stuff now. And, you know, it's about the love. Like, I just started doing it and I just kind of fell in love with it. Yeah, like, the more you do it, obviously, you know, you get great at things, and just about finding your niche.
So, you know what's funny, though, about the whole, speaking of the polished niche or sound, because my partner, Joey Sturgis, he also, for his genre of metal, like, he also had a very polished sound. And I remember back in the day when Andy Sneap was the big metal guy, he had a very polished sound, and people would sometimes talk a lot of shit about them and just be like, every mix sounds the same, like, they're just hacking it or whatever. And that is the farthest thing from the truth. And I have proof that it's the farthest thing from the truth, because the Nail the Mix, if it was so easy to make a mix sound polished and perfect, then at this point in time, we would have well over 10,000 students whose mixes sound better than Joey's.
Sure.
And who are, like, you know, on that level or on the level of any of the people we've had on who do the polished thing, but I hear the mixes that are submitted every single month for our mix pull. We get like well over 500, and I hear them, and it is not easy at all. It's and I know it's not easy, and it's interesting to me that people will sometimes scoff at it until they kind of have to try it, and then they realize that it's borderline impossible.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what drew you to that?
You know, I think just the fact that I could, when I started learning Pro Tools back in 2005 and six, and just, I spent like 8 months, basically just, I had no job. And I just dove in, learned all I could, watched a bunch of videos that were at that time on YouTube. And the fact that I could manipulate, you know, my guitars or my drums, whatever, and make them as tight as I wanted it to be, that just resonated with me. I was like, man, this is really cool. Like I can make records that sound pretty cool now, you know? So I just started doing it. And the more I got into it, the more my love, and this is going to sound funny because everyone hates editing, right?
They say they do.
Yeah, they say, but it has to be done, right? It's one of those things that just, you got to do it. I mean, half the things on my website are just basically me doing, you know, vocals, like vocal editing and comping and tuning for these artists. And I just love, there's something about it, the before and after for me, that's like, man, this is great. Like this is, it might take me like 10 hours to do one song, but it's going to be epic when it's done. You know, that's my thing. And my pop sense of just what I like, it just kind of grew into this thing that I love. I don't know. So I'm all about, I mean, and the thing is too, is like, if someone doesn't want that kind of sound, then I'm not the right guy for it, you know, and I'm cool with that. That's fine with me. You know, it's not like everything I do is completely like, you know, to the T, but I mean, most of it is, you know, it's going to, you know, especially with the artists that I'm working with, or they're all on the pop side of, even pop rock or whatever it is, it's just going to be more, it needs to be perfect, you know?
It's interesting. I just spoke to a guy named Jack Shirley yesterday on the podcast. He's a producer out of the Bay Area, and best known for his work with a band called Deaf Heaven, which is like a, I don't know what to call them. They're like a black metal band, kind of. But he has the very DIY ethic, which is kind of like very few edits. It is what it is. And his records sound great, too. So what I think is important for people to realize is that what matters here is knowing who you are as a producer and having your own voice and being able to tell artists that don't fit in with that vision, or hopefully getting to that point, because obviously when you have no clients, you kind of have to take what you can get. But working to get to the point where you can say, this isn't a good fit, and this is, and should work with this band and not that band, because that band wants something totally different, something that I don't do.
Absolutely. There's been times where I've put bands in the direction of different producers just because I knew that I wouldn't fit what they were going for, you know? And I'm totally cool with that. I think, you know, it's like I said, it's just kind of like, it's about finding what you're great at and what you love to do and make that work, basically, you know?
Did you ever regret sending a band to somebody else?
It's happened maybe 3 times in the last, like, you know, 10 years. So it hasn't been great. So no, it's not a lot. The thing is, like, since like 2009 or so, or 10, the people that come to me kind of know what they're getting themselves into, basically. So it hasn't been a thing. It hasn't really been a thing where it's like, you know, very often that happens.
Yeah. Just the fact though, that you're willing to say that, it's the same thing. Just like if someone goes to Jack Shirley or Kurt Ballou wanting what you do or what Joey does, that's dumb on the band's part. I remember when I was working at a studio in Florida that did all this extreme metal stuff, we would get people who wanted the Joey Sturgis sound, and it would be like, well, go to Joey. Like, that, you're coming to the wrong place. This is not, we don't do what he does. What he does is great, but that's not what we do. And if that's what you want, you're going to be sorely disappointed when you get the mixes back. And I learned kind of the hard way by taking on clients that wanted what somebody else could deliver at times, and then them not being happy and me getting frustrated. And then it took once or twice for me to realize, look, it's not even worth working with these people because, you get paid, but they're not going to come back.
Right.
They're going to have a bad impression of working with you,
mm-hmm.
and you're not going to be able to do your best work for them because there's a bad vibe, because what they want is what somebody else can do. So, you know, if you know from the outset that people want something that's not in your wheelhouse, do the honorable thing, in my opinion. If you can afford to.
Correct. If you're just kind of like getting going, you're like, man, I got to take some work, then maybe you just go for it and do your best, you know, but.
Well, there's also the thing that at the beginning stages, there's two things that I think should be happening. Let me just say that before I start pissing everybody off, that let me just give a disclaimer that I understand that this is not possible for everybody, okay? So this is not possible for you out there. Like, don't get mad. I'm just saying that this would be ideal, when you're first starting out, that your overhead is as low as humanly possible, so that even if you're not getting that much work or any work, you find a way to pay the rent so that you can say no to artists that aren't going to help you progress, or you just take those as practice sessions or whatnot, mm-hmm. But not serious sessions, so that you can open yourself up to saying yes to the right people. But, you know, it might involve not doing some paid work for a little while,
mm-hmm.
Offering your services for free in order to win over certain people, or turning down other artists that you don't want to work with. And if your overhead is really low, that might be possible to do. Mm-hmm. And look, if you're trying to start a production career and you have three kids and a mortgage, you may not be able to do that. But, you know, if you're 21 or 22 and, you know, maybe you have a little family support, or, you know, figured out how to live for cheap and have a part-time job, then it's way easier to do this.
Absolutely.
So you're a musician first, right?
I am, yeah.
Okay. So how long did you do the music thing before the production thing came along?
So my first band, Hang Nail, was on this label called Tooth and Nail Records. We did three records.
Oh, I know Tooth and Nail. They're a good label.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, you did August Burns Red, right?
Yeah, August Burns Red, yeah.
Nice, nice. So we did two records with Hang Nail. That was 98 was when we graduated high school. And we were actually a band like 3 years before that. So basically, out of high school, 98, we put our first record on Tooth and Nail. And then we toured for like a year or so and did the same thing for two more records. So that was 98 until somewhere 2002 or 3 or so. And then we broke up, long story. But I joined this band called Acceptance from Seattle. And so I moved out to Seattle and we did a record out there with Aaron Sprinkle, that was on Columbia Records. So we toured for like we had an EP that came out first, and then we did a full length. That was like almost a 4-year run of touring. So that was, and then that ended at about 2006 or so. So it's been since 98 to 2006, was pretty much on the road and making records and doing all that stuff. So 2006 then is when I actually, Acceptance broke up and I moved to California with my buddy Christian from Acceptance. And we started a new band out there and we were living with our manager for a while. And then 6 or 7 months later, after we moved there, he got a call to join Emberlin. So he went and did that. So and then I went back home to Milwaukee.
The end.
The end, yeah.
So do you think that all that experience, though, as a touring musician, helped you relate to your clients better?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a business. We're on the road doing our thing, being a business. And so we have to figure out how to make that work. And, you know, and yeah, and talking to, you know, to people every day and every night at the shows and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so absolutely. And I mean, even what I learned from the producers that we worked with those making those records, I wasn't really into production, but I was getting into it as we were making these, as like for Acceptance, especially watching Aaron Sprinkle do his thing and learning from just learning what I could from him. It was pretty cool.
He's great, by the way.
Yeah, he is. Yeah,
I haven't heard his work in a minute, but I mix engineered a Demon Hunter record.
Oh, nice.
Back in like 2012 or something. That he produced, and the production was immaculate, and not just that, but super musical. He's just really, really good.
That's the thing, and he's a genius musician, which just helps everything out when he does starts doing production work, you know. Yeah,
working with him, so that made you kind of see the light as far as production goes.
Absolutely. Yeah, because what was cool about it was that the band would come in and we'd do a day, you know, we'd record whatever we need to, drums or guitars. And then like the next day we'd come in and there'd be like just extra production stuff that just sounds epic to us. And it's like, he would just do that like on his downtime, you know, before we were even there at the studio. And that happened all the time. Like he just hears these things and he does it so fast, which is kind of incredible to me. He hears it and he'll just go, oh, I know what I need there. And he just, you know, throw it in there and it sounds perfect. So yeah, so knowing that a producer could actually add to the song, you know, I mean, as far as like, as long as the band's okay with it, he can write stuff for the song or do whatever he needs to. And seeing that, I didn't realize that. I thought like, back then I just thought a producer was just going to like, you know, basically an engineer, hit record and let the band do his thing. So seeing what he added to our songs was very eye-opening for sure.
I guess after working with him, I guess what was the inspiration that got you into recording? Was it just like, this guy is, now I know what you can do, the band's done, got to do something? Or how did it come along?
That was pretty much exactly what it was. Like, so yeah, the band was done, I moved to California, and those 7 months in LA was when I purchased Pro Tools and just started going for it, and didn't have a job. We're just living off some publishing money that I had, and I spent it all. But that was my training for Pro Tools. That was like my school, and I just kind of learned all I could. And then when I came back to Milwaukee after those 7 months, I moved into a space, a studio that was in it's in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and I used a space there and started just recording bands and just went for it.
Did you still have hope for the band thing to work out, though? Or were you kind of like, been there, done that, doing this now?
I think for the first year after, a year and a half after the band broke up, I was like, within that year, I was like, I kind of wanted to still do the band thing, right? Because we were still hot. It was a thing still. I was kind of into it. But then after that year and a half or so, I just kind of started, you know, as my production stuff started building, I was like, you know what? This is better. I can stay home. I can probably have a family at some point, and I'm kind of done with the band thing. And I mean, for me, it's been like, it was like 7 years of touring. So I was kind of, I was kind of over it then after that year or so.
I could just totally relate, because I had a band that, I guess we got together in 2000, but got signed in like 2005 or six, and ended right at the end of 2010, 2011, and right coinciding with when I got my first bigger studio gig. I had been recording for like 10 years before that, but for that first year of the band being broken up, I was thinking, maybe I'll start another band. Mm-hmm. Like I had a few false starts, and I think it was just like wired into me, like from all that touring and all that. It just being in a band that's actually doing something is so like life consuming that it's hard to just put on the brakes and stop. So I think for a good year, I was kind of halfway wanting to maybe do another one or something. But then at some point, it was around a year as well, it was just like, nah, you know, this is way better. And the idea of starting another band, it just fills me with anxiety.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. There's no way I could, even when bands come in and I'm producing bands, it's like, man, I don't want to say it to them, but I'm kind of like, man, this is, you guys, good for you guys. Like, this is like a big task, especially nowadays, you know, with how music is, but like, I couldn't even think twice about doing that now, you know, starting a new band, or, you know, it's a big deal.
Yeah. Like, I mean, more power to them. And
exactly.
There's actually, I feel like there's a lot of great bands now. Like in the past few years, there's been a resurgence in quality, and I'm very, very happy about that. I'm stoked beyond belief. But the idea of starting a band just and like going, being in a van and like starting from this beginning, just like, it just fills me with dread. Like, I would never do it. And but like, yeah, it took a year to get that out of my system. Interestingly enough, though, production wasn't it for me either. I was kind of into it, but I never totally gave myself over to it. I tried, but it just wasn't the right fit. Oh, what I'm doing now is, but what I'm doing now kind of is built off of what I did in production and what I did in the band, all of it kind of put together into this thing. But, it's interesting to me, just like when people make transitions, like whether they're forced transitions or not forced, like at what point they're 100% aligned with that transition and when they're kind of there and kind of not. And I find that most of the time it's kind of there, kind of not at first.
I would say that. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even for me, I was living with my parents in 2006 when I came back from California and living for free. I knew a bunch of bands around Kenosha, Milwaukee, Chicago. So I started with, you know, just dirt cheap deals for these guys. Like, hey, come on in. I'm learning too. Let's learn together. Let's figure it out. You know, I think for me, I have a weird personality where I feel like when I do switch something over, like if I'm going to come right off touring and go into this production thing, I kind of just have to go. I just go for it full on. And now I did get a part-time job at the post office working on Saturdays just to get by for those first couple of years of me figuring out how to record bands. Right. So I did do that, which helped pay some of the bills. But again, I was living for free at my parents. So I was like, okay, this is, I mean, if I had a rent to do, if I had a rent or if I had a wife or kids, like there's no, that would have been much harder transition to make happen.
Yeah. Well, I actually just mean the mental part of it. Cause when I've made transitions like that, when I decide to do something, I go all in. Mm-hmm. Like when I decided to start URM, I stopped making records. Like I didn't do some records and then try to start a company at the same time. I was like, I'm going to start a company now and that's what I'm doing. And then when I got that first big studio gig, like that was it with playing in bands. And I actually got a bunch of opportunities in that first year and I turned them all down and had only one false start that lasted like 2 weeks.
Wow.
With some musicians. And I turned down a bunch of opportunities because even though I kind of halfway wanted to take them, it was just like, look, you have to make a decision. And the decision is, are you going to do the studio thing or are you going to do the music thing? You can't do both really, really well unless you're a freak, and you're not a freak. So make a decision.
Yeah.
And then the same thing later. It's like, are you going to start a business or are you going to be a producer? Make a decision, but don't be a producer with a half-ass wannabe business on the side. Like, make a choice.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you have to make those choices in life. Cause I really believe that statement, you can do anything you want, but you can't do everything.
So, yep. Totally.
Yeah. I definitely do believe that's true. So I have a few questions for you about some of the specific work that you've done. So, you worked on the Color Morale's Pray For Me acoustic release, and the song itself has real beautiful warmth and clarity. And can you talk a little bit about your work on this one?
Wow, dude, that's that's going way back there for me. I got to think of, that was, you know, honestly, it's a bit of a blur because that was done like in probably 12 or something, maybe, or somewhere in there, 13, 14, maybe. That was like a one day thing. And I can't even honestly remember how it went. I'm not even joking.
I think that that's a good enough answer. The reason I'm saying that is because I get emails all the time asking me, like, so what were the amps used on this record from 2013? It's like, dude, I don't know.
I don't know what I ate for breakfast this morning, so I can't really tell you.
Yeah, like, I don't remember last week.
The only thing I know from how that came about was Devin King was in a band before that I recorded his band, and that was probably, 2008 or something, or 9. And so we've stayed in contact, and that's kind of how that came across my plate, was through Devin asking me to do that for them. So that's all I remember from that session.
Well, it came out great.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
So back to the transition between touring and production. With all that touring that you did, I'm guessing that you had a substantial opportunity for very good networking, especially, you know, just all that touring and then living in LA for a while. And I feel like when you're in that situation, the point is just making it work and not totally blowing it. It is easy to totally blow it, but, you know, if you don't totally blow it, it's a huge opportunity to plant lots of seeds for the future. Do you have any social advice you might be able to give listeners to help navigate social waters when they're in, I'd call, fruitful or potentially fruitful social situations?
Yes, I do. Because I learned it the hard way, because I wasn't like the social butterfly in the band. So, I hung out and talked to people, but like after the show, I was in the RV going to sleep, because I was like the morning driver. I wake up at like 7 and start driving. So one thing that I regret from all those touring days is keeping those contacts and saving those kind of contacts, you know, in your phone or wherever, you know, wherever. And we toured with a ton of bands that I had some great opportunity. I mean, I did, you know, create some good contacts, but there was a lot more that I could have had if I would have taken the time and said, hey, let me get your number real quick, or let me just, you know, get your email and we'll keep in touch, whatever. I think that's the thing that I, after coming off the road and going into production full time, I realized like that I had some great opportunities that I missed because I was here in the room with these people and I could have just created more contacts. And so that's my advice for all these young guys out there. Like whoever you meet, you never know. Like, I mean, for me, it was like, you know, I remember going on tour with this band called Fall Out Boy, and, you know, we were all in vans back then. And, you know, Patrick would come in.
I've heard of Fall Out
Boy. Yeah, you've heard of them, right?
They win like some Guitar Center competition or something, like local band of the year.
I don't even know. Probably.
No, I'm kidding. Maybe they actually did.
No, you're right. No. And I just remember like that's a good example is this when Patrick would come into our van and he was like just kind of playing guitar and he's writing some stuff. And like, we thought at that point, I thought like, who's this guy coming into our, like, we don't even know him very well. It's like our second day of tour. And he wanted to like write songs with us. And we're like, okay, that's cool, man. You know,
just because that's how he is. He just likes to write music.
That's just how he was. Yeah. Back then he's just a writer. He writes like crazy, you know, and now it's like, now looking back, I'm like, man, I wish I would have created a better relationship with Patrick, you know, or all those guys. So you just never know who you're going to meet and who those friends could become. And, you know, I don't know. So yeah. That's my regret from all those years of touring and not really keeping a ton of those contacts.
So I kind of share that with you, because I actually think that I kept a lot for being such an introvert. And actually, a lot of them now are coming back into play, strangely enough, like, because I have to talk to a lot of label people in order to secure rights for Nail the Mix. And a lot of people from my past are popping up, and I'm really thankful that things were left on a good note the majority of the time. You can't win with everyone, but the majority of the time it was left on a good note. But it also makes me think that because I'm introverted, I also was the guy who would go hide a lot of the time after a show or something like that. And who knows how much more I could have amplified things now if I had taken the time to meet even more people and be friends with even more people. Because based on how much my network has done for me as is, I can only imagine that it could be multiples, maybe.
Sure.
So I highly suggest that people don't put themselves in a position to regret not having seized a relationship with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Without being a punisher at the same time.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Yeah, it has to be a real relationship.
Exactly, yeah.
Which actually I find is the tough part, because if you're not feeling sociable, it's hard to fake it. It's kind of a catch-22.
It kind of is, yeah.
I found a lot of times that networking in the moment was basically, it was never something that led to business in that moment, or very rarely was it like networking now leads to something now. It was always about planting a seed for later. Do you have any stories like that where some networking you did at one point in time led to a future client or a future opportunity or something of the sort?
I mean, yeah, I kind of feel like that's kind of like the norm now, as far as the last 4 years have been. One example is with Acceptance being on Crush Management back then, and now Crush, you know, has Panic! At the Disco and Fall Out Boy and all those kind of bands. I've kept in contact with some of those guys, and now this was 2005 when Acceptance was happening, and just about 2014 or so, I reached out to him and said, hey, you know, how's it going? And just, you know, kind of reaffirming what I do, you know, nowadays, and see if they have any work for me. And they got me a couple things from that. It was just me just reaching out with an email. And that's how I got the Andrew McMahon in the Wilderness mix that I did for them. And what else did I do for them? Something else, I can't remember. But that's one example, but there's a ton, I'm sure.
So you knew them from 2005, and when did you reach out to them?
2014. So 2005 is when they were our manager for the band.
Uh-huh.
And every other year I would kind of reach out, and we'd still keep in touch with email, but not really like asking for work, you know, or something like, hey, I want to do some Crush stuff. You know, it was more just saying hi. And then in 2014 is when I kind of like reached out and said, hey, you know, I'm doing production stuff and mixing. Let me know if you got anything. And they came back and threw me some work, which is great.
It's interesting though, because that's exactly what I'm talking about, is years of not asking. Over the years of keeping that relationship alive, I'm sure that they realize that you're sticking around and are not, you know, not full of shit,
right?
Basically.
Yeah. I think that's probably why I didn't reach out sooner, because I was still like, I just wanted to get really good still. So I just needed some years to get to a place where I felt like that I was worth it, basically. The whole like mundane stuff that you do every day to me is it doesn't go unnoticed. It's like, it's a thing that you're constantly learning. So it's, you just want to, you know, every day it's like, even though some days might be harder than the other days, but you're still learning through all that stuff, and it makes you better, you know? So.
Absolutely. So how does all this lead to Hillary Duff?
So that's a good story. A friend of mine, Jared Bettis, he's a producer in Los Angeles now. So I have a bunch of people in LA and Nashville that send me songs to work on and to mix and to edit and that kind of stuff. So he was a big part of getting me some good jobs. One being that Melissa Etheridge record that I mixed as well. But he's got his hands in all kinds of stuff out there. He's writing with artists. And so he worked on a song with Hillary for her last record. And so basically what I did with Hillary, all I did for that song was I comped and edited her vocals. I didn't do any production work, although I did track some background vocals in Kenosha for that song. All the things on my website, it's so random, but like there's all these things come from different people that I've met or known, and people that trust me to do this stuff. But so that's how the Hillary Duff thing came about.
Hey everybody, if you're enjoying this podcast, then you should know that it's brought to you by URM Academy. URM Academy's mission is to create the next generation of audio professionals by giving them the inspiration and information to hone their craft and build a career doing what they love. You've probably heard me talk about Nail the Mix before, and if you're a member, you already know how amazing it is. At the beginning of the month, Nail the Mix members get the raw multi-tracks to a new song by artists like Lamb of God, Opeth, Meshuga, Bring Me the Horizon, Gojira, Asking Alexandria, Machine Head, and Papa Roach, among many, many others. Then at the end of the month, the producer who mixed it comes on and does a live streaming walkthrough of exactly how they mixed the song of the album and takes your questions live on the air. You'll also get access to MixLab, our collection of dozens of bite-sized mixing tutorials that cover all the basics, and Portfolio Builder, which is a library of pro-quality multitracks cleared for use in your portfolio so your career will never again be held back by the quality of your source material. And for those who really, really want to step up their game, we have another membership tier called URM Enhanced, which includes everything I already told you about and access to our massive library of fast tracks, which are deep, super detailed courses on intermediate and advanced topics like gain staging, mastering, loan, and so forth. It's over 50 hours of content, and man, let me tell you, this stuff is just insanely detailed. Enhanced members also get access to one-on-one office hours, sessions with us, and Mix Rescue, which is where we open up one of your mixes on a live video stream, fix it up, and talk you through exactly what we're doing at every step. If any of that sounds interesting to you, if you're ready to level up your mixing skills and your audio career, head over to urm.academy/enhanced to find out more.
When you're working on something that's, I guess, there's a lot riding on on something like that, maybe. And not to say that it's more or less important than like a rock record, but there's typically a lot more riding on it just because there's a lot more money invested typically in a pop artist than a rock artist. There's just more. I feel like the stakes, depending, obviously, you know, if it's Slipknot or something, you know, stakes are pretty high. But in general, pop is way bigger than rock, and the stakes are higher. Is there more pressure on your end when you get handed something like that and are told, do your thing? Or is it just another song that you're just going to do you on and hopefully they love?
I think there's a level of importance when, you know, when a song comes in for like that. Like, it's, again, it goes back to just the practice. Like, I feel like I've had so much practice now that I feel pretty confident going into like a Hilary Duff and making sure it's like her vocals perfect, you know, that kind of thing. So I think, but still there is a level of, yeah, there's, you know, her A&R, and then there's all these people at the label that it needs to be perfect. Otherwise they're not gonna love it. And that particular song was not recorded that well, her vocal. So there's a lot of noise, a lot of just stuff all over the place. So that one was a bit hard. But I would say, you know, I spend a bit more time just to make sure it's like, okay, you know, I go through with a fine tooth comb and as opposed to, okay, you know, here's the normal whatever rock band I'm doing. Like, I know it's going to be fine in the end, but there's no label behind it. There's no, you know, it's all indie stuff. So there's a level of, you know, importance there.
Yeah, just the stakes are way higher. Can we talk a little bit about your process of what you mean by fine-tooth comb, and especially as related to a recording that's not as good? Reason I'm asking is because most people listening, the stuff they're going to be working on is not going to be that great. I mean, sometimes, you know, they'll get the opportunity to work with some pristine tracks. But by and large, they're going to be working either with local artists who can't sing very well or mixing stuff that wasn't recorded very well or whatnot. And so we're, you know, polishing something that just wasn't executed that great on the engineering end or whatever is kind of common. So can we talk a little bit about your fine tooth comb process?
Sure. Yeah. That's a pretty deep question, but I think I can try to answer that.
You can get nerdy.
Okay. I'll get a little nerdy. Yeah. Well, I will say that, and this is why I like what I do, but I like as far as like being a post guy and making things nice on the back end, as far as editing goes. I would say 80% of the songs that I get to mix only, the vocals are just not, they're just not great. You know, they're either auto-tune is on set with auto and you can hear everything everywhere, or they're actually tuned, but they're super bad tuned.
By bad, you mean like to the wrong note or?
That, or you can just hear the tuning very, very well. Yeah, which I'm a fan of not hearing tuning.
So unintentionally able to hear the tuning.
Correct, yes. And that's kind of probably why I started doing a lot more editing stuff, because I feel like there's, I just got sick of hearing every song I get to mix. It was like, okay, well, what's going on with these? Why is there so much noise in these guitars? Or why, or you know, why aren't these palm mute guitars tighter? You know, they're like 50 milliseconds off or whatever, whatever the thing may be. I like to hear it tighter. So I think drums, for one, I mean, you know, who's not replacing drums nowadays, right? That's going to help the drums in a nutshell, kick snares or toms, whatever you're doing to replace drums. But again, if you don't have rooms or overheads that are recorded nice or good, it's just not going to sound good. It is what it is. You can only do as much as the source gives you. But for guitars, you know, if you're doing rock or whatever it is, and there's tight palm mutes all over the place, like those things have to be feeling good with the drums and the kick and all that kind of stuff. So that's, you know, I'll spend time, and if they're not good, I'm just gonna do it, and you know, I'll save a alternate playlist just in case the band freaks out that they want it sloppy. That's fine. To me, it's all about the vocals. So if the vocals come in and if they're not tuned at all, which happens that's fine. If it's like real bad, I'll ask the producer. If it's like okay, we'll just leave it and go for it. But if it's bad, I don't want to like just go through it and put out something bad. I want to talk to the producer and say, hey, listen, you know, these aren't tuned very well or whatever. I'll say it in a nice way and say, hey, can we just tune these, or can we, or do you want to leave, should we leave them as they are?
Hey, buddy, never tune anything again.
Right. So, you know, I'll take, it's kind of, for me, it's about taking those extra steps, because if it's going to make the song 5%, 10% better, then that's, I think we should do it. That's, I mean, why not? Basically, you know, if it costs, I mean, maybe I charge them a little bit to do it, whatever. But to me, it's those small details that make everything. And I think for vocals too, it's one of those things that every song you get is just so different. If I'm mixing and you just kind of have to take it as a song by song project and just see what you got to do to it, you know?
What are some of the common issues you get, though, besides the tuning being fucked? And a second part to that is, how do you go about fixing the bad tuning?
Okay, well, the vocals to me are the first thing that will pop out and be like, okay, this is not good. The drums would be the second thing that...
No, but I mean specifically in vocals, like when you get vocals, let's talk only about vocals.
Okay.
Like when you get vocals specifically, what are the most common problems you get with vocal tracks besides the tuning?
Timing, I would say. I mean, tuning's the one, obviously number one, but timing, I think too, is it has to feel right. It has to feel like it's in the pocket, and that would be. I think timing is for tuning, it's like I hear that in like every song almost I get, but for timing, that's less of an important thing. But I for me, because I do so much vocals, I just hear all that stuff. I hear like, okay, why is the chorus so early on this line? And why is it, you know, so I'll just go through and kind of like time those things a little bit better if I can.
Man, I don't know if I agree with you that it's not as important. Like, I almost feel like it's equally, because if the feel isn't there, if it's not in the pocket, like it makes me insane.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I meant that just like what you hear first of all, like when you first,
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's got to be in the pocket. And that's, I think, my process of doing vocal editing for a song that I produce is pretty intense, but it's like a fail-safe way to get to the end result. And it's like, okay, there's no questions about it. Like, here's the vocal, and that's kind of what it is, you know?
Do you get issues often where shit was just tracked in a horrible environment, so you have like weird room reflections in the microphone that somehow you got to get rid of, any noise problems like that?
It happens, I mean, from time to time, not very much, but those are the kind of things that I will attempt to do some magic EQ, whatever it is, and then go back to the producer and say, hey, this this is how it sounds. I can't do much about it. And if they want to recut the vocals, great. But if not, then that's just kind of what it is, unfortunately.
So I've always thought that, like, really the one thing that is the hardest to fix and is the most, I guess, the most appropriate for a redo is that bad vocal environment stuff. Like when they track in a room that just has reflections all over the place and you just have just weird shit in the mic that you can't EQ out. It's just there. Like, I've heard that Isotope RX can fix it to a degree, but I personally don't know of any way to really, really fix that stuff.
Yeah, I heard some great things about that plugin as well, but I think you're right. I think it's like, you just got to recut the vocals, you know, basically.
I think that RX does magic, but it does magic for stuff like noise. I could be wrong. I mean, hey, listeners, if I'm wrong here, please let us know, because I personally have never used it. I just know a bunch of people who use it and who have used it for me. And so what I understand is that you can definitely do some black magic with it, but I know that I have given vocal tracks to somebody to try and fix that were, you know, given to me that were like recorded in a bathroom or something. They weren't fixable. It's happened a few times, and I've never had anyone actually successfully, or me, be able to fix that problem.
So what did you do then in that occasion? Did you just go back and say, hey?
I asked them to retrack the vocals.
Okay, yeah.
It never happened when I tracked them. Like, when I track vocals, I set up a fucking fort. Like, I don't like vocal booths because vocalists tend to not like vocal booths. Mm-hmm. And I like to be in the room with the vocalist. Mm-hmm. It's just better for me. And for them, like, just the way that I work is I like to be able to look them in the face and just, I don't know, it just works better. Mm-hmm. But because of that, I have to build a fort, and basically I build a gobo fort that goes up to the, you know, have a thick carpet underneath them, gobo fort in front and on both sides of them. Mm-hmm. And then also on top. So we make the fort about 7 feet tall or something like that. You know, a little bit taller than the singer so that he doesn't feel claustrophobic.
Right, right.
And then we do put a gobo on top, and then she sings from inside the fort. And, you know, usually it's a 57, which has really good, you know, rejection from the back. So you're good. Even in a more live room, I'll build a crazy ass fort. Like, I'll go to great distances to make sure that the room is not messing up the vocal take.
Sure, absolutely. That's the worst one. If you don't do that and you go back later on, and you're like, oh shoot, now I hear it. You know, that's the worst. Yeah.
Well, you know, I fucked up vocals back in earlier days and got reamed out for it. So it's never fun to be told that you have to tell a vocalist to redo everything because it's your fault.
Absolutely. Yep. I just heard a podcast the other day of a producer working with the band for 3 weeks, and then he lost everything, and he had to go back and just say, hey, we have to redo it, or I'll give you your money back and you can go somewhere else and do your record.
Was that me?
No, it wasn't.
Because no. I do have a story like
that.
Oh,
do you really? Wow.
Yeah. What happened, and listeners, forgive me if I've told this before, but my studio got struck by lightning back in like 2005, pre-cloud backup or anything like that. It got struck by lightning right when I was backing up. So I had both backup drives hooked up, but I was doing like a mirrored backup, like I always did, and I was working on two records at that time. And they were on all three drives. So the internal drive, and then two glyph drives. Remember those?
Mm-hmm.
And then two glyph drives, the big like steel ones that they used to have, the Firewire ones. So like they were backing up, and the weather was getting bad, and there was like 3 minutes left on the backup. So I'm like, 3 minutes, okay, 3 minutes, as soon as this is done, I'm unplugging everything. And at about 30 seconds to done, lightning struck the house, and basically shit exploded. Like,
that's crazy, man. Wow.
It was like when you see like a submarine room in an action movie take a hit and sparks go everywhere or something. It was frightening, and it was also pink. It was pink electricity. That was the weirdest part. It was, I don't know if you've ever been near a lightning strike, but it doesn't, at least I've been around two, actually. I was near a basketball pole that got struck once. I was sufficiently far away to where nothing happened to me, but like, so I've been involved in two lightning strikes.
That's crazy. Wow.
Possibly three, actually, because I think my house, wait a second, I think my house in Florida, okay, my house in Florida was also struck by lightning, and it took out our septic. But, wow.
I'm not going to come near you.
I've been involved in three lightning strikes, if you can believe that.
Wow,
shit.
Wow, that's crazy. So you lost everything on those drives then, right?
I had not just that. Like, the computer was gone. All the outboard gear that was hooked up to it was gone. Like, gosh. I lost a lot of stuff in that. But one of the bands was there with me when it happened. Mm. We had just finished tracking, and we were just, like, smoking a joint and, like, backing stuff up and talking about the session when we're going to get back together. So they witnessed me noticing the weather and being like, okay, we got 3 minutes left and I'm unplugging everything. Like, so they were there and they saw that, like, I was aware of it, and we together were like, yeah, let's just give it 3 minutes and then we're done. And so they saw the explosion. They knew it was true. And so then I said, look, we can retract this for free. Or I can give you your money back or something, but they agreed to retrack.
Okay.
And it came out way better. However, the other band who wasn't there, they went somewhere else, and I think that they thought I was lying. And you know what? The reason I think that is because I would think I was lying too.
Absolutely.
So I think that they think, or they thought that I just lost their shit, or, you know, so, you know, something dumb, like spilled a beer on it and lost all, you know, who knows what they thought, but I don't think they believed me, or they didn't care. I offered them the same thing. Like, we'll redo it all for free, but then they were gone.
Okay. Wow, man. That's crazy. Yeah.
Shit happens.
Back your stuff up, kids, in three places.
Well, but cloud didn't exist back then. So what I would do was I would have one on the internal, one on an external glyph, and then another external glyph that I would take with me to my apartment.
Perfect. Yeah.
In case the studio house burned down.
Absolutely. Crazy.
Yeah, the weakness was backing them up at the same time.
Sure.
But that's why I'm kind of OCD about it now. Like, I think that everybody should have something like Crash Plan hooked up in addition to doing multiple physical backups.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I still hear stories all the time. People just losing their stuff, you know, it still happens. Yeah.
I lost something first time since the lightning strike. That was longer. So first time in 14 years, I lost a file somebody sent me. Like I said, it's the first time I had lost something in well over a decade. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe I lost it. I don't know how I lost it. It was like a 30-minute thing somebody sent me. I don't know where it went. It didn't end up in any of the online backups. There's no record of it on my shit. I have no idea what happened. He had deleted it off his Dropbox, so it was just gone.
Wow.
It kind of killed my self-esteem for a good day.
It still happens to the best of us, but I mean, and it's just the worst when it's like if you spend more than like a day on something, you know, if you maybe a day, you can kind of like, okay, I'll go back and redo it for a day if I have to. But if you're like 2 weeks deep on something, that's just the worst.
No, it wasn't like that. It was just, it took him like an hour to do, and then he sent me a 30-minute edit of it. I just felt terrible. And I also teach people to back shit up.
But love it.
I mean, shit happens.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, shit happens. So how did Stone Sour come about?
So that was just a thing where I just worked on his demos. So basically, here's a quick backstory of my starting off in production. The band Skillet is from my hometown. For those of you who don't know who Skillet is, they're a bigger Christian rock band. And Ben Kaska was the guitar player for Skillet back then. And when I started doing production at the studio that I rented out at down in Kenosha, Ben had stopped by and I met him at the studio there. And we started talking about stuff, and he was a producer as well on the side. And he's like, I got all these bands I want to record, but I got no time. I'm on the road with Skillet and I'm pretty busy. So do you want to do it? I was like, yeah, that'd be great. So that's kind of how like we teamed up, and the company Skies Fall was born through Ben. Ben started this company, and at first we were just a recording studio and I was like the main guy doing everything. And then it turned into like a recording studio and slash film. We started doing some videos and doing all this stuff. But Ben had the opportunity to go and write with Corey. He did that. He flew out to Corey's house, did some demos, brought them back. And I basically took those demos and did my thing with them, edited, you know, made him sound great, fixed vocals, all that kind of stuff. And so that was all that was for the Stone Sour stuff. It wasn't like a record thing. It was just all just kind of demo process for him.
Still though,
it's cool.
Pretty damn
yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
It's interesting because, even Ben was like, man, I'm about to go on a flight to go to Corey's house. And like, Ben's a Christian obviously. And Corey's probably, I mean, I'm assuming he's not, but he's like, this is going to be interesting to see how this goes. But he loved it. He thought they hit it off great, and it was fantastic. So Ben had a great time.
Yeah, I think Corey's pretty outright not.
That's what I figured. Yeah, yeah.
I've only met him twice, but I know a lot of people who know him though, and I have never heard a bad thing about him as mm-hmm. a person. And mm-hmm. my two experiences with him were that he's like one of the most positive, uplifting, easygoing, cool, charismatic people. Mm. Like I could go on and on. Like mm-hmm. he's fucking cool.
Yeah.
And so I figure that anyone cool going to work with him would probably have a good time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, at least now, I don't know about back in 2007 or
right.
2003, but like, what I've heard about Corey Taylor now is that he's just a kind of an unbelievable human being to be around.
Mm.
And like I said, my two experiences with him were interesting. I know he wouldn't remember, but I found them to be interesting because I've experienced a lot of people talking about successful people as though they were lucky or something like that. You know, a lot of people don't like to credit the person who
mm-hmm.
who made it to the top. Or they, you know, they try to assign some sort of advantage that they had or something like that. And I've always thought that, yeah, you can get, at least in music, you can get your foot in the door for sure if you have some pre-existing advantage, like, you know, your dad is at the top of a label or mm-hmm. you're super rich and your dad offers to match the label's advertising budget. I've seen stuff like that happen, but it'll only get you that far. It mm-hmm. won't keep you in the game. It might open a door, but so that said, I don't believe that you can ever get to that top level without deserving it. Like without,
sure,
because
sure.
the public can't be fooled.
Mm-hmm.
And not mm-hmm. to that extent. Like you can't go multi-platinum and stick around for that long without being the real deal. And so when I met him in person, it was instantly like clear that this dude is a star. Have you ever seen those cell phone pictures of like movie stars where it's like them and then two non-movie star friends, and it's just like a shitty
mm-hmm.
picture where like they have like red eye and all that stuff, but
yeah.
the movie star just looks like a Greek god or goddess,
yeah.
and then their two friends just look like normal people, and it's like, yeah, that's because that's what they look like. that's not some invention, and it's with that frontman charisma
mm-hmm.
or that star-like charisma mm-hmm. that someone like Corey Taylor has, that's who that person is.
Yep. Absolutely.
I've always thought it was interesting that sometimes that gets discounted. It gets discounted a lot with pop artists, too. It bugs me.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone gets there by accident.
Sure, sure.
Or at least stays there by accident. Well, that was my rant on that. So it sounds to me like what you've got going on is a really good example for what's possible if you do really great work and just kind of stick to your guns. It doesn't matter if you did the demo for Stone Sour or the album, but you keep working and you keep getting work. And it sounds to me like people are coming to you for what you do, and you're getting to work with clients that you enjoy working with and doing your thing. And I think that that's kind of living the dream.
I mean, I can't complain right now. I love what I do. I think just recently it's been more of a thing where I'm starting to maybe say no to things I don't want to do. And this is just only happening. This has probably just been the last couple of years here, but before that it's been like, okay, I just kind of need to, I have two young kids and a wife. And so with what we have one income, so it's a bit like, I gotta pay the bills, you know, for now. But, I feel like it's slowly transitioning into, I want to work on more things that I want to work on and less of maybe just like, I'll pass on that kind of thing, you know. But that's my motto, man. So I just kind of like, I figured out what I like to do, what I feel I'm good at, and just really take that to the next level and see. And I think also for me, like when I first started recording bands and stuff, and, you know, I was a nobody, I still am a nobody, but, you know, they come to me with songs and we'd record them and they would leave. You know, it'd say we did like a 5-song demo. They would leave, you know, after the week, whatever it was. And then I'd start giving them mixes back and they'd be like, man, this is, you know, I think taking the time to edit stuff and to make sure it's nice and neat, the band, that's kind of how I feel I built this thing basically, is by getting these bands in that may not be the greatest bands in the world, but they have good songs, and just, you know, making them sound great, and then them telling their friends, and then, you know, and so on. And I think that's, you know, kind of how this whole thing started for me. And that's kind of why, that's what I love to do, is that kind of thing. And so I feel blessed that I can still be doing it this many years after I started, which is awesome. So, yeah.
Do you advertise at all?
I don't. I just have a website.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's basically word of mouth.
It's all word of mouth. Yeah.
The reason I'm asking, I ask almost everybody this, is because I really, really believe that advertising is a waste of time for producers. Because every producer I know did it all through word of mouth. I mean, they might have a website, but the website itself isn't going to, it might reaffirm who you are if someone's already curious, but they're not going to discover you
exactly
off of the website.
Exactly. Yep.
So I always tell people that they need to work on building relationships in their portfolio and then let the word of mouth do the work for you.
I mean, it's all about the work. Yeah, exactly. And then it speaks for itself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no better endorsement than a former client or a current client or a song that somebody loves the sound of. That's way bigger endorsement than punishing somebody with a business card at NAMM, which is about to happen to me.
Have fun with that.
You probably guessed from this conversation that I'm not huge into large crowds of people. This is the first year that I've ever been like an exhibitor at NAMM. I've always gone as an artist or a guest or something. And I've only really gone once every other year lately, or even 3 years, just because I don't like being in big rooms with a whole lot of people and a lot of fucking cacophony everywhere. But by the time this comes out, NAMM will have already happened. So this year, URM had a booth, first time ever. And I'm actually kind of excited about it, but my schedule is just like filled to the brim. And I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. I don't want to say I'm dreading it, but I know that I'm going to probably need you know, days to recover. But it's a very different thing going in as an exhibitor than it is as an attendee, because I don't know, it's just a lot easier to make meetings. So I'm actually kind of excited about it this time.
I think that's going to be huge for you guys. Yeah. I mean, congrats on that as well. That's pretty cool.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll ever do it again. I thought it was important to do it at least once, but I kind of feel like now that we are an exhibitor, it's time to make up for any networking I didn't do in the past.
There you go, man. That's the place to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the shot at redemption. But on the topic of word of mouth, as related to what we were talking about, the worst thing I feel like people can do, and, you know, I just thought about it because they do this at NAMM, is come up and punish somebody and just put a card in their face and try to sell their service in the first 5 minutes of meeting them. That's one of the worst ways to network with somebody. I think that the best way to do it is to just make friends. And it doesn't mean friends that you talk to every single day. It can be a friend that you catch up with once a year or something. But, you know, just get on a positive footing with somebody and let it develop naturally. Like you said, like, it took you 9 years with that label, management company, knowing each other from working together previously, but then keeping the relationship alive in a casual way. And I have several people that I know, too, that maybe I worked with or came across professionally back in the touring days, who then I just kind of, you know, we'd say hello once a year, maybe have lunch like once every 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then recently, for some reason, they came up through something for Nail the Mix and they were there and I could just hit them up and we could make it work.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I actually have one more example that I just thought of early beginnings with Acceptance being on tour. And there's this band called Trios, or The Receiving End of Sirens. And that was one of the bands that we kind of became closer with as far as being on tour and kind of like becoming friends and that kind of stuff. So the drummer for that band, Andrew, he's, we've somewhat kept in contact, not very well, but we just, you know, we obviously know each other and we're somewhat friends back then. But he's now playing with Dan and Shay, who is like the biggest country act pretty much in the world, I feel, right now. And it's just such a random thing. And so I'm going to see them coming up here in March and just going to go hang out with an old friend that I haven't seen since 2006, you know. But it's one of those things. It's like you never know who your friends are going to become or people that you meet. And, you know, life takes you in some crazy places.
Yeah. And that's exactly why you should try to stay cool with everybody. However, don't beat yourself up if that's not 100% possible. Everyone I know who says that still has, you know, a few people that they had that falling out with, and some bridges are not meant to be left standing, but, you know, 90% of them should be. You know, so some are better burned down, you know, so the Nazis can't cross them or something. But dynamite that bridge. But you know, for the most part, you never know. Yeah. It could be 10 years or 15 years before that relationship turns into something. And at the very worst, and this is not a bad thing at all, but at the very worst, you have a friend. You say that nothing ever comes of it work-wise. Nothing wrong with having a friend, you know?
Absolutely. If I knew back then that I was going to be doing production in the future, things would have been, like working for myself. Oh, yeah, I got to get contacts. Things would have been differently. I just, you know, back then it's like you're in a band, you're on tour, you don't really think about a year, you know, 1 year ahead of you.
Let alone 10.
Exactly, yeah.
The thing is that it's not even production. It's like, you don't know what life holds. Like, you could be in an industry that doesn't even exist in 10 years. Like, for instance, what URM is doing, we didn't exist 10 years ago. I could have never imagined that I'd have something going on that didn't exist back then, but where all my contacts from before were somewhat relevant. So, like, people don't think about the fact that there's stuff that hasn't even been invented yet that they might be involved with, that the people they meet now could come into play to help out with, or, I mean, let alone production.
Yeah.
That too, of course, or another band or whatever. Who knows? Maybe you end up at a label and you want to
helps, you know, you want to sign a band and you know this band because you toured with them and that gives you the edge. You know, you never know what it's going to be. So that's why you should take these all seriously and especially never look down on somebody because they might be in a on a lower rung on the ladder career-wise. Because, first of all, they're not lower on the rung humanity-wise. They're equal to you as people, and you should treat them that way. And also, because career-wise, they might be controlling your ladder at some point.
Exactly.
In the future. So all the more reason to keep things cool. But Nick Rad, I think this is a good place to call it. And I just want to thank you for coming on. And is there any way that people can find you that you want to plug?
I guess the best way to find me is just my, well, my website, nickrad.com, or I'm on Facebook, Instagram. I think my Instagram is Nick Radovanovic. It's a long one. Sorry about that. But yeah, if you just search for my name, you'll find some stuff.
Yeah, and we'll link to it in the show notes as well. So, Nick Rad, thank you, and have a great day.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The Unstoppable Recording Machine Podcast is brought to you by Hairball Audio. For nearly a decade, Hairball Audio has been helping musicians and recording studios improve their recordings by offering high-quality outboard recording equipment in do-it-yourself kit form. Check out the full line of compressors, mic preamplifiers, and do-it-yourself parts at hairballaudio.com. Hairball Audio. Do it yourself without compromise. This episode of the podcast is also brought to you by Shure. Legendary microphones, cutting-edge wireless systems, premium earphones and headphones. Shure, the most trusted audio brand worldwide. For more information, go to Shure.com. To ask us questions, make suggestions, and interact, visit urm.academy and press the podcast link today.